Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. This is Steve Savitsky. And today, as always, we always have interesting people, but today we have a really special person, Alan Sakowitz. And Alan is an author of a book called Miles Away, Worlds Apart, which was actually reviewed by Toby Katz in our fall edition of the Jewish Action. I'm sure everyone is going to get a chance to read the review, and I did. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
No, it's my pleasure. Really, it's my pleasure. And I guess the first question is, what motivated you to write the book? You know, what inspired you?
Well, there were really two things. First, after the Scott Rothstein matter...
You know what? Let's just get back for one, since a lot of people don't know. Let's quickly give a synopsis. What happened, and then what was your involvement? Then we'll get into why you did it, because most people probably don't know anything about the story.
Okay, Scott Rothstein is a Madoff-type Ponzi scheme, which was the largest fraud in the history of South Florida. I was invited to a major law firm. It was one of Florida's largest law firms to invest in pre-litigation settlements and to invest for myself and for other investors. And when I met with the CEO of the law firm, I saw something wasn't right. Nothing made sense. The numbers didn't make sense. The returns were about 15 or 20 times what they should have been for the risk. And when I finished doing my due diligence, I realized the law firm was selling things that never existed. And eventually I went to the FBI to protect other people.
Why do you think, by the way, it took so long sophisticated people invested in this thing, so didn't they come to the same conclusions that you did?
Well, I think at least a couple of things happened. One is some people looked at the return and they just didn't ask questions, because when you could make 200, 300, 400, 600% on your money with no risk, you just don't want to ask questions. The return should have been about 12%, because the way it was explained, there was virtually no risk. So some people just went in and didn't want to hear anything else. Other people realized that it was a scam and just walked away. Many people must have figured out it was a scam, and they figured, let me just get out of it. Thank God I'm not involved. And probably there was a group that knew what was going on and figured, let me get in. Let me get in on this Ponzi scheme, make a junior Ponzi scheme, and I'll get out before anything happens, and I'll make a lot of money.
Uh-huh. Okay, so they kind of maybe even knew probably something was wrong, but, as long as you're making money on it, you figure, why not? Why shouldn't I do it?
Right, and if you get caught, you could say, look, the governor of Florida was saying that Scott Rothstein is the greatest guy around. The governor of California was praising him. Every major charity was raising money from him, and law enforcement was saying he was the real deal, and athletes, where everyone was testifying that he was the greatest person around, because they were all receiving money, and like sheep, they were just going along with it. Even if they didn't know what was happening, they weren't checking it out, because there was just too much everyone was receiving to find out what the truth was.
So, this term that people use, a whistleblower, I don't particularly like that term, by the way. I don't like it, but I think you were just trying to do something that was right, correct?
Right. I just saw that it was easy to tell what was going on, but you get blinders when everything is so good, and you could make so much money. Just to give you an idea, I've been speaking a lot. In one place, they were charging $18 for people to come, and I thought, instead of paying $18 to hear me, what if they put $18 into Scotty Rothstein's world? And let's say they put it away when their child was born, bar mitzvah age, how much would that be? In the bank, maybe the $18 would be $25 or $50. With Madoff, maybe it would be a couple $100. But with Rothstein, it would be $2.7
billion.
That's billion.
Billion.
Billion. To give you an idea how much money that is, if it's in $100 bills, it would be 8 times the height of the Empire State Building. So I could understand why someone puts $18 into his investment, because you could make $2.7 billion. Even if it's not real, you lose $18. But how a family put $100 million in, I don't understand, because that's more money than exists. $100,000 for 13 years would pay off the national debt of $14 trillion. So
wow.
The numbers were staggering. And when you do the first bit of math, you see it wasn't possible.
And he was selling this to people all over the United States, right?
He was selling it to anyone who would listen, and everyone was told, don't tell anyone, we're only talking to a a few select people. And even after I got involved and I turned them in, I was getting calls from people telling me that I could get involved in this. And first I was telling them it's not real. Then I realized I better see if I could meet with them and convince them not to invest, because people just were totally blinded. It was just too good to pass up, and so they didn't. And the reason you asked about why I wrote the book, there were really two reasons. The first thing was, since Scott Rothstein was Jewish, as soon as this broke, it came out in blogs saying what happened. He's Jewish and he's religious, which he wasn't religious. He pretended to be everything, but he wasn't religious. Blogs started to say, thank God for Shabbos, that Jews could only steal 6 days a week, and then Judaism is a scam. It's just a way to funnel money to Israel, and there were just horrible things said. And so I asked Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, could I write a response to what's going on from what I saw on the inside and from what I see in my own community, and respond to what Judaism is without ever saying this is a response. I would tell the story of Rothstein in the front, and the background would be stories from my community in North Miami Beach, Florida, showing what chesed is and showing how people help people, and then the reader could decide for themselves what Judaism is. That was the first reason.
That's a great reason. There's no better reason than that, that's for sure.
And my second reason was that it was so easy to see how this was. Nothing was hidden. All I had to do was ask simple questions. When you look in the book and you see the questions I asked, I didn't ask anything special, and I didn't need any special knowledge to know what was going on. He just needed to focus on what he was saying and not focus on the riches. So I wanted people to see how simple it was. So especially when teens get in a situation like this where something's too good to be true, I want them to know what the end of the story would be. And so I was hoping that kids would read it, but I found that a lot of adults bought the book, and when they just put it down, their kids picked it up and looked at it and read it on their own. If they were asked to read it, they never would have. And I've just gotten a lot of feedback, and so I'm very happy that it's reaching that goal.
No, that's great. So Scott Rothstein, his Ponzi scheme was a lot different than Madoff's, which was very sophisticated, obviously. Madoff's was sophisticated. You could be a sophisticated investor, and, you know, unless you really start to dig, you may not know. Here, you're saying it was just easy to understand. No one's giving you 300-500% return on your money without any risk. It just doesn't make any sense.
That's absolutely true. With Madoff, you could have easily been fooled. Here, I went in to invest with Rothstein, and he was going to pay me 207% return on my money. He had investments that were paying 67% return. And first, when I saw that they paid anywhere from 67% to 207%, I was thinking, if you can't see anything, if everything is equal, why would someone invest at 67% when they could get 207%? Which, mind you, 67% risk-free is phenomenal.
Yeah, 6% risk-free is phenomenal. Right. Unbelievable.
When I found out people were making 600%, I was even more amazed.
Wow.
I felt that 207, I'm not getting anything. But when you look at the 207, why would somebody discount something to give me a 207% return when the money is already in his trust account and it's getting paid out over months? Like my situation, I was going to buy three payments of $300,000 each. So in 30 days, I'd have $300,000, another 30, $300,000, a third 30, I'd have $300,000, and I was going to pay $660,000 for that. It's too high a return. And I was wondering, why would someone do it? I wanted to speak to the seller, because if I speak to the seller, I'll understand it. He wouldn't let me speak to the seller.
Right. And to get these kind of returns, what was he doing, he says, anyway?
What Scott was doing was he was settling pre-lawsuits. No lawsuits were filed. And the reason lawsuits were not filed was if he said he filed lawsuits and settled them, anyone could go down to the courthouse or today go online and see if there really was a lawsuit. He was saying he wrote a letter on sexual harassment and he settled the case. The facts were so harmful that the victim would be paid. The perpetrator would immediately settle the case, and the victim would be paid. But he had so many cases. By my last meeting, he was explaining how many cases he had, and I calculated he would have to bring in 12 new cases a day, settle 12 cases a day, speak to investors, and he said he was doing all the work himself. He didn't have any other attorneys. It's just not, practically it's not possible, and then the numbers itself weren't possible.
Why did he want to have, why did he need investors if he was doing this? What was the point of investing?
Excellent question. What happened was he had the settlements, and they were paid out over 3 months or 5 months or 6 months with the idea that it was to be kept confidential. And if a victim got their money all at once and they're upset at their boss or somebody else for certain sexual harassment, they would immediately tell people. But if the money's coming in month by month over a few months, they start to cool down and move on with their life, and they would not say anything. But these victims, a third of them wanted their money immediately.
Oh,
they didn't want to wait a few months. Selling that flow of payments.
Oh, wow. Unbelievable. So I see. So in other words, he won a $1 million lawsuit, and the guy wanted it right away, so he gave him $500,000, and then he got the rest of the money over 6 months, and therefore he was able to get a great... So he needed the money to pay these people off. Meanwhile, the returns were fantastic.
They were too high because the position was that the money was already in his trust account.
Gotcha.
And if the money was in his trust account, then even if they talked and they went to court and tried to get the money back, by then the money would all be paid out. So there was very little risk of anything going wrong. If there was a lot of risk, then you make big returns. If you're investing in a new product or oil or something, you make big returns, and there's a good chance you lose all your money. And people invest because there's a relationship between the risk and the return.
I like the way Toby Katz, I guess, was a friend and neighbor of yours. When she writes the article, she describes you as the Jewish Columbo. You know, that was kind of a great description. Always asking these little innocent questions at the end. Oh, by the way, why is this and why is that? Is that really what happened, more or less?
It was very simple, and the reason I want people to know how simple it was. If I understood something very sophisticated that allowed me to do it, or people said that I'm an attorney and I have a master's degree in tax law, and that's how you figure it out. If that's what it was, then I can't help other people if you needed so much knowledge. But a fifth grader that had their eyes open would understand what happened. He was offering something with no substance. I wasn't even allowed to look at the agreements. I couldn't talk to his attorneys. I couldn't do anything. And when you can't figure anything out, you just can't invest.
Gotcha. That said, it said that you went to the FBI. You were afraid to go to the local police or other people because what he was paying people off. Is that what it was?
He had about 60 or 70 Fort Lauderdale police officers working for him. They were on his payroll. He wasn't even paying the Fort Lauderdale Police Department, and they were paying the officers. He was paying them directly. Broward Sheriff's Office was very close with him, saying he's the greatest guy around. He was contributing to the governor's campaign. He was on the governor's council of 25. He was on the nominating committee of the 4th District Court of Appeals. He was on the police advisory council. So I had to be careful. Almost anybody I could go to was either getting money for their campaigns from him, or they were getting money on side jobs from him, and I just didn't want to get killed. I wanted to try to help people, but I needed to stay alive, too. I chose the FBI because it was least likely that he infiltrated them, and I spoke to them on the telephone. But in truth, my going to the FBI didn't stop him. It was 5 weeks after I went to the FBI, Rothstein's scheme ran out of money, and that's when it collapsed. And the FBI came back to find more information. And even when I went to him, the first thing we wanted to know is, do I have an axe to grind? Why would I be turning in the most influential person in Broward County and one of the most influential persons in the state? And they wanted to look into me and see what was it that I'm going after him for, rather than go over and go to Rothstein.
Amazing. Totally amazing. Well, let's kind of switch gears for a moment, okay? Because what we're more interested in is you wrote the book, and you wrote it because you're really trying to show the good in people, that we could be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, we could sanctify God's name and not create a desecration or L'chilul Hashem as Scott did. So you took different chapters and you devote like things that he used kind of for evil, and other people have used it for good. So why don't you just give us an example or two of something like that?
Okay, in each chapter, I wanted to talk about what Rothstein did and then how in any Jewish community. In fact, in any community, people do better things. And I had stories of Bikur Cholim, or how we started the chapter for the Hatzalah in our neighborhood, or even we had stories of, I think the one that Toby writes about is a red car.
Somebody... So let's hear about that. Okay.
Okay, Rothstein had 23 cars. He had Bugattis and he had Rolls Royces and every kind of car. He gave his partner a Porsche. He gave his secretary-turned-chief operating officer a Maserati. But he didn't have a red van. In our neighborhood, one of my neighbors saw that different people are coming in for surgery or for treatments, and they don't have transportation. They don't have a lot of things, but he thought if he could get them transportation, it would save them money and make their life easier. So he went out and bought a red van just for a family that was coming in for an operation, and they were here a couple months. And after they left, he used that vehicle to give to other people when they lost a job and or their car was in an accident, or for whatever reason they needed a car. And he just gave it to them free. He paid the insurance. He paid the repairs on it. And one day his sister was in town, borrowed the car, got a very bad accident, and the police didn't know how people survived the accident, but they ended up getting out without a scratch. And I thought it was a great story of how when you go do chesed and when you go to help people and your whole purpose is to do things for others, you live a totally different life. And that was one car Rothstein didn't have, even though he had 23 others. And it's a much more valuable car and a much more valuable way of life.
Fantastic. Give me another example of that.
Okay, I was mentioning in the book there's a story of where I went to visit someone in the hospital. I was doing legal work, and I went to see my client, and I noticed in a room there was someone from my neighborhood that that nobody knew. He's pretty much invisible. He moved in the neighborhood. He was in a wheelchair, and chances are nobody even knew he lived in our neighborhood because he didn't go to shul. So I saw his name there, and I figured I'll go visit him afterwards and see who. Just say hello, try to cheer him up. So I walked in the room, and he was smiling and happy to see me, which is something I never saw because he never was upbeat. And I'm speaking to him for a couple minutes, and he asked me if he could tell me why he's so happy. He said, "You probably never saw me so happy." So I was glad to hear, and he told me that his wife was in the hospital, so he was home alone in bed, and he didn't have any meals. So his wife called Bikur Cholim and asked if they'll provide meals for him and wash his clothing. So they called up a couple people from Bikur Cholim, and one of them happened to be a law professor. One of them was a social worker. They worked hard during the day. They cooked a beautiful meal that they may not even have time to cook for their own family, but since it was for someone else, they brought it over. But when they saw this individual, they saw that he was in no condition to just have his clothes cleaned and meals. He needed much more than that, and they were afraid that he wouldn't live at home. So they told him he needed to be in a nursing home where he'd get skilled care, that he wasn't in good health. And he said he didn't disagree, but he doesn't have the money, and he doesn't have family that could help him, and he's not sure he's covered by Social Security or Medicaid or insurance, and so he is where he is. And they said, that's not good enough. We've got to take care of you. And so they called up a neighbor who works at a nursing home and told him the situation and said, "I'm not sure you're going to be able to get paid, and if you're paid, I'm not sure how, but right now this person's life is in danger. Could we bring him over right now?" And he was transported there. He said they took such good care of him. They never asked him how he's going to be able to pay or how he got in this trouble or why he didn't save up money or where's your family. All they wanted to know was what's best for him. And he said that he feels like the most important person around. And I happened to, I only heard the story from him, so I went to the people that it was about. I asked each of the three. I asked the person with the nursing home, "Is it true? Is this what happened?" He says, "Exactly like that." And I asked the people who were involved, and they told me that it wasn't what we did for him. They said that us helping him out, we were the ones who benefited the most because he was such a nice person, such an appreciative person. And I think it's a difference if you look at what you could do for other people, the whole world is better. If you're just asking, like what Rothstein did was he tried to get people to see what was missing. They could have a good family, a nice job, a good car, a nice house. Everything could be going well. But if they focus that they don't have an airplane like him, they don't have a yacht like he has, they don't have 10 houses in a row, or whatever it is, then you're never happy. But when you're looking to see how you could help other people and how to make it a better world, then everything is good. Yeah. And you could do things you never would be able to do if it wasn't for helping other people.
Hmm. What a beautiful,
that's what I want to show.
What a beautiful story, what a beautiful message. And using, you know, Rothstein as a background, you know, to say, here's somebody who exemplified what's wrong with the world, evil, you know, greed, you know, how people could become really like angels. I believe that people have the ability to really transcend the world and become angels. So your book is really, I mean, really right on the money. You know, let's just kind of end it with this. You know, what message would you like the readers to take away from your book?
I'd like to take away a message that if they look at what they could do for other people, they'll not only be happier, they'll live a better life, but they'll make other people's lives better. And by writing the book the way I did, what happened was people bought the book to see about Rothstein. But I've been getting calls from literally around the world from people who read it, and they told me you shouldn't have written about Rothstein. I just love the stories, your neighborhood. That's what you should write about. And I realized that's what I wanted. But nobody would have bought the book if it wasn't
No, you're absolutely right. People would not have bought the book. But meanwhile, what you did is you took the bad, you made it into good, and you put together something really which is a Kiddush Hashem. And that's why we're so happy that we are able to review the book in the Jewish Action. And hopefully people will be inspired by the book. And as I said to Alan before we got on the air, I think it's a great opportunity, by the way, for people out there, you know, who really want to inspire young people. What it's like, and to be careful in the world, and also to look to do good. You know, bringing Alan in, it'll be a fantastic thing. So, how do people contact you?
My cell number is 305-655-1234, and my email address is asakowitz, ASAKOWITZ, at pointpointecompanies.com.
Terrific. Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much. Congratulations on writing the book. I know, I'm sure it must have taken a lot of time, but you've done something really extraordinary, and we're very proud. So thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
Okay.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.